Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week, we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week, I'm happy to say we have Hans Kundinani on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, Utopia or Auschwitz, Germany's 1968 Generation and the Holocaust. It's pretty common in American political discourse to call someone a fascist, but everyone knows this is just name-calling. The people who get called fascists were never really fascists. It's just a manner of speaking about people you don't like very much. This was not true in post-war West Germany, where people were often called fascists as well. There, however, they actually had been fascists. Students in West German universities were keenly aware of this, and they were keenly aware of a lot of continuities between the Nazi past and the West German present. There was, for example, the strident anti-communism, both under Hitler and then in the Federal Republic. Now, they wondered about what to make of these continuities, and they had some help from the Frankfurt School of Philosophers. And here, I think, is where they became rather confused, because they began to equate the Federal Republic with fascism. And once they did that, as Hans Kundinani shows in his book, the course was clear, because there was only one thing you could do when confronted with fascism, and that is to resist it by all means necessary. Now, of course, West Germany wasn't a fascist state, but they didn't realize this. And for the terrorists, it all ended, as Hans shows, rather badly. They were almost all killed. But for many others in the 1968 generation, things ended a bit better. And in the interesting case of someone like Joschka Fischer, it ended with a seat in power, though, of course, a kind of power in a kind of regime that he had not really imagined. This is a fascinating book, and I really enjoyed talking to Hans today, and I think that you'll enjoy the interview. So without further delay, here it is. Hi, Hans.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. We're talking to Hans Kundinani today about his terrific new book, Utopia or Auschwitz, Germany's 1968 Generation and the Holocaust. I read this book cover to cover, and I can tell you that it's absolutely terrific. You may have seen some films about the people involved. I have seen two, actually. The Bader-Meinhof complex is one. And then one I recently saw was about Carlos. I think it was just called Carlos, and it was about a fellow named Illich, Ramirez, I think is his actual name. And it also, we touch base with some of the people that are in Hans's terrific book. So if you have a chance, you might want to look at those films. This is what really happened, which is kind of what we expect out of serious thinkers like Hans. And so I very, very much recommend that you pick this book up. It's a fascinating window into a really conflicted generation of people. And as I was telling Hans during the pre-interview, I, in a weird way, have great sympathy for them, even though they were terrorists. I know that I'm going to get mail about that, but I don't know what else to say, but I just really did. By the end of it, I didn't know what to think about them. But anyway, Hans, thanks for writing the book. Why don't you begin our discussion by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah. Well, I'm a Brit and born and bred in London. I'm not German, despite the first name, which sounds German. It's actually Dutch. My mother's Dutch and my father's Indian, which is where the last name comes from. But grew up in Britain, was always, I guess, kind of interested in German history, and particularly in the Nazi past. Studied German and philosophy at university, and then after I left university, became a journalist. Spent some time working for some British newspapers in Germany as well, and it was actually when I was reporting in Germany at the beginning of the Schröder government, which was from 1998 onwards, that I became interested in this subject of the 1968 generation, because Schröder and other people in that government were from the 1968 generation, mm-hmm. and that's really where my interest in this subject came from.
Mm-hmm. So that leads us naturally into the discussion of how you came to write this particular book. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, as I say, I was a reporter for the Observer, a British Sunday newspaper, at the beginning of the Schröder government, and this government was often described as a government of 1968ers. And I started doing stories about different members of that generation and about different aspects of it. And the more I kind of read about it, the more I talked to people the more interested I became in the subject, and in particular the sort of complexities, really. That's really what I try to bring out in the book, is the kind of paradoxes and the complexities of that generation you mentioned already. It's a very conflicted generation. And I mean, essentially, it's the story of that generation from the 1960s onwards through to the 1990s and then the noughties, when members of this generation like Gerhard Schröder and Joschka Fischer are in government. Mm-hmm. And so I look at the sort of influence of some of the issues which they'd been struggling with since the 60s on the foreign policy of the so-called red-green government. Mm-hmm. And you know, this is essentially the children of the so-called Auschwitz generation, the children of the generation of Germans that were responsible for the Holocaust. And really, the whole book is about their kind of struggle with being what they what one member of the generation who I talked to in the book called it being the children of murderers, and the struggle that kind of results out of that.
Let's start talking a little bit about them collectively. When were they born? We talk about the Auschwitz generation, but...
They're kind of the slightly... I mean, not quite identical with the baby boomer generation, but very similar. They're essentially born between... really during World War II and right after World War II. So, you know, essentially in the 40s. So, for example, Gerhard Schröder is born in 1944 and Joschka Fischer is born in 1948.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I liked about your book is that you make all what I would call kind of distinctions that are internal to German culture, which we don't recognize. So you make a distinction between these individuals who were... kind of this generation, but they were a little bit older, and I think you call them their Flak Helfers or something, or what is
yes,
it?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and
yes, I mean, German. You can break down Germans born, you know, in sort of in the 20th century into these quite neat generations, because German history in the 20th century does break. It has these ruptures. So, you know, 1918, 1945, 1989. Mm-hmm. And so this does mean that the experience of people born on either side of these ruptures is very different. And obviously the biggest rupture is World War II. So, you know, on the one hand, you have the generations of Germans who were old enough to serve in the Wehrmacht. And then the next kind of sub-generation along almost is the so-called Flakhelfer-Generation, which was those Germans who were not quite old enough to be at an age at which they could actually be conscripted, but they were members of the Hitler Youth, and often in the last few years of the war, they were drafted into man anti-aircraft batteries, which is where this Flakhelfer term comes from. And then the next kind of generation along from that is the 1968 generation, which really has very few memories of the war itself, and essentially sort of grew up after the war. So the experience of the Flakhelfer Generation is very different from the 1968 generation, because they do have these personal memories. They were kind of implicated. I mean, they weren't really old enough to be responsible for what happened in the Nazi era. But nevertheless, they experienced it. So, for example, Günter Grass, the German writer, famously is a member of that generation.
Can you name some other people who were members of that generation?
Well, Helmut Kohl, Chancellor, Gerhard Schröder's predecessor as Chancellor, is basically of that generation too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, I see. So let's set the scene after World War II. Germany is, of course, completely destroyed and occupied by the major powers. I think one of the things that people that don't study this era believe, or they have the impression, or maybe it's just assumption, is that it's as if somebody turned on a light switch in Germany in 1945, after May 1945, and all of a sudden the Germans were Democrats again, for the first time, perhaps. I don't know. But the way you describe it in your book, it wasn't like this at all. And one of the things that was interesting to me, and I was happy to see this highlighted a little bit, is that the initial, I guess I would call it the sort of initial regimes that ruled Germany immediately after, or administrations, were strongly anti-communist. And this is associated heavily with the Nazis themselves, who said, you know, they were protecting Europe from communism. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that context, because it's the context within which the people of the 1968 generation grew up.
So obviously, right after the end of the war, Germany is divided into these four different zones. You know, in the West, the American, the British, and the French sectors, and in the East, the Russian, the Soviet sector. And in the West, what becomes the Federal Republic in 1948, you essentially have politicians in power. Konrad Adenauer becomes the first chancellor, who'd been a mayor of Cologne before the war. But lots of other politicians of that era and people who were involved in politics in the immediate post-war era in the Federal Republic in the West, 50s and so on, had been involved in various different ways in public life during the Nazi era. They'd been members of the Nazi Party, or they'd been active in that era in other ways. And so there's a myth that 1945 was hour zero, but in fact there were all these kind of biographical continuities between the Nazi era and the Federal Republic. And the most famous example of that is Hans Globke. He'd been an official in the Interior Ministry during the Third Reich, and had helped to draft, he drafted, in fact, the commentary, the official commentary for the Nuremberg Laws. He becomes Konrad Adenauer's chief of staff. And there are lots of other examples of people like this. So although you have this democratic system in the Federal Republic, there are all these biographical continuities. And as then the post-war generation, which is born, you know, during the war and after the end of the war, starts to hit their teenage years in the early 60s, they start to become aware of some of these biographical continuities and start to question them. They also start to question what their own parents did. And this is one of the things that then leads in the late 60s to this big generational clash between the wartime generation and the post-war generation.
I wanted to talk to you just for a second or hear what you have to say about a program which every American learns about when studying this period, and that is the denazification program.
Yeah.
And one of the things that you point out in the book, at least implying in the book, is that there's only so far it could go.
Yes. I mean, essentially, it was sort of truncated. It was, you know, initially pursued quite thoroughly, and obviously the Nuremberg Tribunal is the most famous attempt to put those responsible for the crimes of the Nazi era on trial. But essentially what happened was, as the Cold War sort of kicked in, and particularly after the Federal Republic was created in 1948, lots of former Nazis were rehabilitated in the judiciary, in politics, in academia, and lots of prosecutions essentially were dropped against a lot of these people. So by the late 50s, you had a situation where there were many former Nazis who were in positions of power and responsibility in the Federal Republic. And young people in Germany experience this very directly. For example, they're teachers, and then subsequently when they're at university, their university lecturers, you know, often were former Nazis.
Since you mentioned universities, one of the things you point out in the book, and I quite like this as well, is that this is a very small number of people, small in the relative sense, of course, and they are strongly localized, A, institutionally in universities, and B, in just a few cities. Frankfurt and West Germany or Berlin are two of them. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what it was like to go to university in the early 60s and what the scene was there. I've been to German universies and I still don't understand them. So I don't know what they do there. They produce really good scholars, but I don't know. I never see anybody studying. So what was it like to be at university then?
Well, I should say, I mean, I wasn't around then, so everything I know about that period is kind of secondhand. I was born in 1972, so from what I've been told and what I've read, before 1968 or before the 1960s, German universities were sort of very hierarchical and authoritarian, and in a sense, West German society as a whole was still very authoritarian at that time. And one of the things that the 1968 generation did was help to make West Germany more liberal, and in particular to make universities more liberal through the protest movement. But I you're right that the West German university system was and is very different still from the American or the British university system.
It really is. So another thing that I liked a lot about your book. Another thing I really liked about your book is that you make it not only the story of a kind of set of ideas and movement, but also of individuals, because it was a relatively small group of people doing this. And so you have these small Lebenslaufen, or I don't know what the word in German is, these sort of stories of these individuals.
Yeah, right.
I think the most fascinating one to me, and I heard a little bit about him, was, sorry, I'm forgetting his name. His name's Rudy
Rudy Dichka.
Yeah, Dichka. Yeah, maybe you could tell us a little bit about him, because much of the story revolves around him. He seems to have, he's a tremendously sympathetic person, except for the bomb throwing part. But anyway, go
right.
Yeah, talk a little bit about him if you would.
Yeah, no, he's the sort of central figure in the West German student movement, which kind of gets going in the mid 60s and then reaches its climax in 1968, and then subsequently after that, the movement kind of breaks up into various different factions, some of which then turn to terrorism. And Dutschke is the kind of pivotal figure, really, in this movement, and he's the sort of the icon, really, of the West German New Left. But what's interesting, and this is one of the things I try to bring out in the book, is although he becomes this figurehead of the student movement and of the New Left more generally, he's actually a very atypical figure within it. Most importantly, he doesn't grow up in West Germany, Adenauer's West Germany of the 1950s. He grows up in East Germany. Actually, he's born Brandenburg. And he comes to West Berlin actually to study in the 1960s, just before the Berlin Wall goes up. And he's then in August 1961, when the wall goes up, he's cut off from his family and stays in the West. And in many ways, that's the beginning of his activism is at that moment. And because of that, he has very different concerns from his comrades who grew up in the West. And in particular, one of the consequences is that he cares deeply about the division of Germany for obvious biographical reasons. As I say, he's cut off from his family, from his mother, who he's very close to. So for him, German reunification is actually part of the revolution. Mm-hmm. But to complicate things even more, he isn't always entirely open about this, precisely because at that time, German nationalism was a taboo on the West German New Left. So he writes, for example, about this subject using pseudonyms. And there's sort of subsequently been sort of lots of debate in Germany about Dutschke's nationalism and whether he really was a German nationalist. I argue that he was, and this was a sort of an important part of his politics.
So I guess, as part of setting the scene, we should also talk a little bit about the political parties with which these people might have been involved had they been legal, I guess.
Right.
I would say.
Right.
So the KPD, the old German Communist Party, was outlawed. Is that correct?
Right. Right. In 1956. So, and again, this is obviously all, this whole story really happens in the context of the Cold War. And you mentioned earlier on the sort of anti-communism that was very pervasive in West Germany. Again, for obvious reasons, West Germany is literally on the front line of the Cold War. And this anti-communism is even more pervasive and sort of slightly hysterical, I think you could describe it as, in West Berlin, which is this kind of island, this kind of democratic capitalist island deep in East Germany. So you have, for example, a virulently anti-communist press there. And this entire student movement emerges against that background, and they see in the anti-communism of the establishment and of the press and of the right at that time, as you mentioned earlier, a sort of continuity between the Nazi era and the Federal Republic. But so the three main parties at that time in the West German political system are the Christian Democrats, the Social Democrats, and the Free Democrats, essentially liberals. And the Communist Party, as you say, had been banned. And the consequence of that, essentially, is that there isn't any opposition, parliamentary opposition, to the left of the Social Democrats. And out of that situation then emerges what becomes known as the extra-parliamentary opposition, mm-hmm. which becomes almost a sort of pseudonym for the student movement. The opposition then to the Social Democrats and the Christian Democrats becomes, on the streets rather than in Parliament. The Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats form a grand coalition in 1966. And this is, a key turning point because it means that apart from the Free Democrats, which is a very small party at that time, you have the two biggest parties in a coalition with each other. And so, as I say, opposition essentially moves onto the streets. And this galvanizes the student movement.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that I found very interesting about the book was the way in which you weave in, I guess, what I would call the intellectual life of these people, and how strongly they were influenced by the what we call in the United States the Frankfurt School, and really they were in a kind of constant dialogue with these people. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the Frankfurt School and how they affected the 68ers.
Yeah, as you say, they have a sort of a complicated relationship with the Frankfurt School. They're very much influenced by Theodor Adorno and Max Horkheimer and Herbert Marcuse, but in quite complicated ways. And then, although they're influenced by them, they sort of reject them at a certain point in the development of the student movement too. So the Marcuse is an important figure for the new left everywhere, really, like even mm-hmm. in the US. And in fact, you know, at the time he's in the US, he's in California. Most of these members of the Frankfurt School had left Germany during the Nazi era, and the Frankfurt School, the Institute for Social Research, as it was called, had actually moved to the US during the war. And Marcuse stays behind and actually goes and works for the State Department after the end of the war. But Adorno and Horkheimer return to Frankfurt. And so the student movement is they see Adorno and Horkheimer as their inspiration, and nearly all of their ideas come from the Frankfurt School. In particular, their definition of themselves as an anti-authoritarian movement comes from Adorno and Horkheimer's work on authoritarianism. And then, and yet, over the next few years, from the sort of mid-60s onwards, they gradually start to reject Adorno and Horkheimer as not really being radical enough, and in particular, not being practical enough, essentially, mm-hmm. not being prepared to actually take action. In Berlin, I mean, this is very much in Frankfurt, because Adorno and Horkheimer are actually there, they have a huge influence on the Frankfurt branch of the SDS, which is the main left-wing student organization. Meanwhile, in Berlin, Marcuse plays a much more important role. And in particular, he's a huge influence on Rudi Dutschke, who's in West Berlin.
One of the things that's very curious about these people is if you compare them to... I think if you compare them to their counterparts in the United States, that is, people in the 1960s, they're much more what they call theoretically oriented. They're constantly
right.
having reference to these texts. You find them
right.
reading the One-Dimensional Man or something.
Yeah.
And they really
yeah.
twist themselves into knots trying to
yeah.
to write themselves with this theory. Where does this impulse come from?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, It's absolutely right. They really take this all very, very seriously. You know, as I mentioned, you know, Marcuse is an influence on the protest movement elsewhere in the States and so on. And obviously, you have a similar protest movement in France that culminates in May 1968 in Paris. But as far as I can tell, none of these other protest movements. None of them were as intellectual as the West German student movement was, and none of them thought so seriously about political theory as the Germans did. And as you say, they tie themselves in theoretical knots, and this then leads eventually to justification of terrorism in the 70s as resistance against the so-called Auschwitz generation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, it's absolutely fascinating to see them try to square what they see on the street with what they find in these books, because it's a very hard thing to do, and they don't really succeed in doing it, because I don't think it could have been done. We'll talk about some of the they really create a kind of a thought world within which they exist that I don't think really had much connection with reality. That's editorializing
right.
on my part, but
right. No, that was my impression too. Yeah.
Yeah. So things really get kicked off here after a fellow named and his name is interesting in German. His name's Onasorg, isn't it?
Yeah.
He
yeah.
gets shot. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Mr. Onasorg gets shot. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how things sort of spin out after that?
In June 1967, the Shah of Persia comes on a state visit to West Germany, and the West German student movement should probably sort of take a step back and explain that its politics had been developing in the mid-60s around solidarity with national liberation movements in the Third World and critique, essentially, of American imperialism. And the Shah of Iran was seen as being, you know, an American client regime. And so the student movement mounted a series of demonstrations against his visit in June 1967. During the course of a demonstration on June the 2nd, as the Shah of Iran was in the Deutsche Oper, the opera house in West Berlin, a student named Bennett Ornesorg was shot by a West Berlin policeman. It's recently emerged that, in fact, he was working for the Stasi. That wasn't known at the time, which is a sort of a further irony to this story. But this moment when he gets when he gets shot becomes a sort of a catalyst really for the student movement to radicalize, and that's really the beginning of the sort of confrontation between the West German student movement and the state.
Mm-hmm. So let's return just for a second to their thought world, and tell me if I'm wrong about this. They believe, and this is largely as a result of having read Adorno and these fellows, that the enemy is international imperialism, right? And it's led by the United States, and there's some sort of similarity between the United States and Nazism somehow. They seem to conflate these things.
Yeah,
yeah. So their target is imperialism, and imperialism, as we all know, because we've read Lenin, is driven by capitalism, and the biggest capitalist country is the United States. What do they think about the Soviet Union?
There are different factions within the West German student movement that have slightly different views of the Soviet Union. And again, this is where the fact that Dutschke grows up in East Germany makes a difference, because in fact he's slightly more critical of the Soviet Union and of communism in general than some of his comrades who had grown up in West Germany were. Some of them tended to romanticize the Soviet Union. And you know, weren't as critical of it as they were of the US. I think their position can best be described as anti-communism, in the sense that, you know, as we've already discussed a little earlier on, they saw anti-communism as a manifestation of these continuities between the Nazi era and post-war Federal Republic. But the different factions had different views about communism itself. Some of them, again, influenced very much by Adorno and Horkheimer, also rejected the Soviet Union as a model. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be correct to say that they were simply communists. Mm-hmm. They were more preoccupied with the problem of anti-communism, as it were, than the problem of communism, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very interesting, because this leads them to, again, one of the other things that they conclude is that somehow Israel, and this puts them in a very odd position, Israel is somehow a client state of the United States, and that Zionism is really imperialism. Now, again, that may or may not be true. I don't know. But they don't question this anymore. They really think this is true. And this puts them in a very odd situation. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, this is one of the absolutely fascinating things I think about this story is that, as I mentioned, on the shooting of Benno Ohnesorg happens on the 2nd of June, 1967. And 3 days later, on the 5th of June, the Six-Day War starts. And this conjuncture, these two things, that the West German student movement radicalizes precisely at the moment when the Six-Day War, which, you know, transforms the Middle East in many ways, has all kinds of very complex consequences. Mm-hmm. Up to the time of the Six-Day War, the West German New Left had been pro-Israel. The German term for this is Linkszionistisch, left-wing Zionist. Younger people in West Germany had tended to be more pro-Israel than older people. And Israel essentially was seen by the New Left up to this point as being a country of Holocaust survivors, as a refuge for Holocaust survivors. And what then happens in a very, very short space of time is that perception of the Middle East is turned on its head. I mentioned earlier that the West German student movement was particularly interested in national liberation movements in the Third World, like the Viet Cong, for example. And what happens is they start to see the Middle East and Israel in this same theoretical framework, where the PLO is one of these national liberation movements fighting against imperialism in the Third World. And so Israel then is seen as being bridgehead of American imperialism in the Middle East. And so in the same way that the United States and West Germany, Federal Republic, are associated with fascism, so Israel is also associated with fascism. And this is, I think, a very good example of what you mentioned a minute ago, these kind of theoretical knots that they tie themselves in. Because very quickly after the Six-Day War, at least some people within the West German New Left start to see Israel as a Nazi state. They equate it with Nazism. And that then in turn justifies resistance against Nazism, sort of ex post facto resistance against Nazism. And I would argue that that then leads to, for example, terrorist attacks, not just against Israelis, but against Jews later on, that the people who carry them out are able still to perceive as being anti-fascist resistance.
Yeah, I find this all this kind of amazing, because one of the things that I'm trying to write in my own head is that these people were extraordinarily well-educated and were intellectuals, had read very deeply, but the categories within which they think are the opposite of subtle. So that anybody who fights a war over territory is instantly an imperialist or a Nazi, regardless of who they are. It's really brute force. I don't know how you can put anybody who knows the history of these things, and they did. I don't know how you could put these things in the same category, but they did. How do they get to the point they're actually committing terrorist acts? Because they hadn't heretofore.
I mean, it's a very black and white worldview, and the transition to terrorism is. I mean, I think it's very difficult to kind of find a moment where this transition from legitimate protest to terrorism happens. It's a very gradual process, and that's, I think, precisely what makes it so fascinating. I talked earlier about Rudi Dutschke. And there's been a lot of discussion about his role in this transition from protest to terrorism. The concept of resistance, it seems to me, plays a key role, because I think the error came much earlier, was to define West Germany as a fascist state. Mm-hmm. The moment you do that, then violence does seem to be legitimate, in the same way as during the Nazi era, acts of violent resistance would be seen as being legitimate. If you understand the post-war Federal Republic not as a democratic state, but as a fascist state, which is increasingly how the West German student movement saw the Federal Republic in the late 60s, then really all these discussions about what they call the Die Gewaltfrage in German, the question of violence, become really questions of sort of tactics. Mm-hmm. Is violence against property or against people, is it going to actually help you overthrow the West German state or not? They cease then to be moral questions, because you've defined the state as a fascist state.
So one of the things that happens that actually I think leads them, if I recall correctly, just to return to the narrative, is that Dutschke himself gets shot.
In April 1968, Rudi Dutschke is shot. He doesn't die. He's shot three times in the head by a sort of deranged German nationalist. This is a further irony given Dutschke's own German nationalism. And for a few days, it's unclear whether he's going to survive. There's massive protests in West Berlin. And then shortly after, he does recover. He has a very long, difficult convalescence, but leaves Germany fairly soon afterwards and leaves a massive void, really, in the West German student movement. And what's interesting is that precisely because he leaves, this subsequent emergence of terrorism, it's not entirely clear what role he played in that. He had the process, I would argue, was already starting to happen, sort of increasing radicalization before he'd been shot. So, for example, he'd been planning attacks on US military installations, mm-hmm. and he'd received explosives. I mean, there's a great story about how he received these explosives from Gian Giacomo Feltrinelli, who is an radical Italian publisher. He transported these explosives to a safe house in his baby's pram with his one-year-old son sleeping on top of these explosives. Absolutely extraordinary. And so it was clear, you know, even before he was shot, that Dutschke's thinking was moving in this direction. How far he would have gone is obviously not clear, and it's now purely speculation because he then left Germany, and by the time he came back in the late 70s, things had moved on. He certainly wasn't a pacifist, as I think some people, particularly in the Green Party, like to think of him as being.
Then at the point that they embark on their kind of terror campaign, they break up into factions, and again, right. Maybe you could help us disentangle them.
Yeah.
One of them was the Baader-Meinhof group, and then another was the Red Army faction, and then there was a third one, I think, called the Revolutionary Cells. Is that right?
Well, yeah, and there were more. I mean,
I
should probably preface this by sort of stressing that, and it's not the case that the entire West German student movement turned to terrorism. You know, essentially what happened was, after Rudi Dutschke had been shot, over the next 2 years, from 1968 to the beginning of 1970, the student movement started to fall apart. It became increasingly clear that their strategies weren't working, and different groupings kind of emerged within them. And essentially, there were three different directions in which, as the student movement broke up, three different directions in which members of the movement went. The first was towards the political centre, I suppose. Lots of young people joined the Social Democrat Party. They moved to the centre-left. They saw, particularly in the figure of Willy Brandt, the possibility of that reform through the democratic process could actually achieve some of their aspirations. And Willy Brandt, he's elected in 1969, partly through the votes of these young people who sympathised with the student movement. It has to be said, though, that not many of the leaders of the West German student movement joined the Social Democrats. They saw the Social Democrats as the enemy. The second direction which members of the student movement went was into the so-called K groups, which were these kind of essentially communist splinter groups, which rejected lots of the ideas of the student movement and returned really to sort of old left rather than new left ideas about the proletariat. The student movement had believed, again, this was the influence of Marcuse, that an avant-garde of intellectuals like students could actually be the revolutionary subject, could actually lead the revolution. And that seemed, after 1968, to have failed. And so lots of the people who'd been involved in the movement turned back to the proletariat as the only real sort of revolutionary subject and joined these tiny splinter groups that fought with each other about tiny points of Marxist ideology, essentially. And then the third group were the terrorists. And there was the Baader-Meinhof group, which is actually a misnomer because it should really have been called the Baader-Ensslin group, yes. Gudrun Ensslin being really the key figure along with Andreas Baader. But Ulrike Meinhof, who had been a prominent left-wing journalist, was a much more well-known figure and so tended to be associated with her. And actually, the Red Army faction is the same thing, essentially, as the Baader-Meinhof group. Two different names for the same thing. The Red Army faction was what they called themselves, and the Baader-Meinhof group or the Baader-Meinhof gang was what the media tended to call them. And then, as you say, there were other groups as well, which were smaller, but actually, you know, sometimes even more radical. The revolutionary cells, as you mentioned. You mentioned at the very beginning the Carlos movie.
Yeah.
Some of the people involved in the revolutionary cells also worked closely with Carlos the Jackal. And then there was a third group, which you didn't mention, called the Second of June movement. And that was named precisely after the killing of Benno Ohnesorg in 1967, and that illustrates the way that these groups did grow directly out of the student movement. They saw themselves in many ways as being a continuation of the student movement's ideas.
But they, you know, it's interesting in a way because they get a little bit mixed up with some very rough characters from the Middle East who actually are professional revolutionaries, and they don't like that very much. Maybe you could talk a little bit about their Palestinian, I want to say adventure, but that's not very nice.
Well, again, I mean, this sort of grows out of the interpretation of the Middle East that had emerged after the Six-Day War, and which was shared widely in the West German student movement. It was natural, I think, in a sense, that they would seek to work with Palestinian groups. This culminates in the Entebbe hijacking in 1976, when two Palestinian terrorists and two West German terrorists from the revolutionary cells hijacked an Air France jet and flew it to Entebbe in Uganda, and then proceeded to separate out the Jewish passengers from the non-Jewish passengers, not the Israeli passengers from the non-Israeli passengers, because, for example, there were also French Jews on the flight too, and they released the non-Jewish passengers and kept the Jewish passengers as hostages. And it was the two German terrorists, in fact, who did this separation. So, in other words, clearly an anti-Semitic, not just an anti-Israeli, but an anti-Semitic terrorist attack. For some members of the 1968 generation, like Joschka Fischer, who's a key figure in the book, this was a kind of a wake-up call when they realised that actually this movement that had started as a protest against the so-called Auschwitz generation was perhaps not quite as dissimilar from its parents' generation as it had liked to think.
So is it fair to say that in the course of the early 70s that all of these terrorist groups were crushed?
Well, yes. I mean, I guess so. I mean, the Baader-Meinhof group, I mean, this culmination of this left-wing terrorism of the 1970s is in 1977, the so-called Deutscher Herbst or German Autumn of 1977. There's a bloodbath, essentially, where another flight, a Lufthansa flight this time, is hijacked and flown to Mogadishu in Somalia. It's eventually stormed by GIESG 9, which is a German anti-terror unit that had been set up after the 1972 Munich Olympics. And then immediately after that happens, Gudrun Ensslin and Andreas Baader, who, as I said, were the two key figures in the Red Army faction, kill themselves in Stammheim prison in Stuttgart. And that's really the spell, really, that the Red Army faction had cast over the West German New Left. However, the Baader-Meinhof gang, the Red Army faction, does continue to exist until 1998. Ironically, the year that the Red-Green government, formed of members of the 68 generation, comes to power. From 1977 through to 1998, they carried out a series of other increasingly senseless terrorist attacks that really had no kind of political meaning at all. But they no longer really exercised any huge influence over the broader left. And that's really what interested me in the book, is, you know, the story of West German terrorism is quite well known, even beyond Germany, through the movies, as you've mentioned. Yeah. What I wanted to do in the book was try to show the broader context, and in particular the way that the terrorists were both influenced by the West German student movement and grew out of the West German student movement, but then conversely also the way that really for that 10 years from 1967 to 1977, they also set the agenda for the West German New Left, the broader West German New Left, and, you know, continued to really have the sympathy of big parts of the West German New Left, even where they disagreed with the tactics of terrorists like the Red Army fraction. They considered themselves often to be part of the same struggle and had the same objectives. And their differences with them were, as I say, differences of tactics rather than anything else.
Mm-hmm, I see. So let's actually move the story forward then, and I think we can do it effectively through the story of Joschka Fischer himself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Eventually he ends up as a foreign minister, doesn't he?
Right.
Yeah. How the heck does that happen?
Yeah, it's an extraordinary political journey. I mean, essentially, tell a very long story very quickly. The ideas of the 1968 generation kind of move into the political mainstream in Germany. And this happens partly through the Social Democrats. I mentioned earlier that some young people who'd sympathised with the student movement in the 60s joined the Social Democrats, and their ideas start to make their way into the political mainstream that way. And then in parallel almost to that, you have the emergence of the Green Party in the second half of the 1970s. And Rudi Dutschke returns after having been away from Germany for years. He starts to get involved in the embryonic green movement, environmental movement that becomes the Green Party in the late 70s. And he'd actually just moved back to Germany in 1979 when he finally dies. He has an epileptic seizure and drowns in his bath on Christmas Eve 1979. Again, it's a tragic end to his life. But he'd committed himself to the Green Party, which he saw as a kind of a second extra-parliamentary opposition. Then afterwards, in the early 80s, other members of the 1968 generation, above all Joschka Fischer, join the Green Party, even though actually they're not particularly interested in environmental issues, but they see it as a vehicle through which they can actually kind of resume their political activism, this time through democratic means. So Fischer becomes elected as a member of the Bundestag in 1983, and then gradually works his, you know, turns out to be an incredibly effective politician, and gradually works his way up. And in 1998, you finally have the first red-green coalition, in other words, a coalition of Social Democrats and Greens, that comes to power, and Gerhard Schröder becomes the Chancellor, and Joschka Fischer becomes the foreign minister. Mm. And what I try to do then in the sort of last third of the book is to look at the influence of 1968 and the ideas of 1968, and in particular this question of how the 1968 generation deals with the Nazi past and the influence of the Nazi past, the influence of that on the foreign policy of the Red-Green government. In particular, the Red-Green government faces these three major foreign policy crises in Kosovo, Afghanistan, and then finally Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And what do they do? Why don't you tell us a little about
that? Well, it seems to me what's so fascinating about it is that these two figures, Schröder and Fischer, embody two currents within the 1968 generation and within the student movement. And so although they agree with each other in terms of policy on these three different crises, they approach them in very different ways, and they're motivated, they have very different motivations, and they have two very different ideas of German identity after Auschwitz and consequently of German foreign policy. So the question essentially in all three cases, it revolves around the involvement of Germany in military intervention. In the case of the Kosovo War in 1999, the Red-Green government decides to send German troops into combat for the first time since World War II, and does so mainly as a result of Fischer's passionate defence of that course of action. But the justification that he uses is very much to do with the parallels that he draws between ethnic cleansing in the Balkans and Holocaust itself. Then similarly, after 9/11, Germany sends troops, first of all, as part of Operation Enduring Freedom and subsequently ISAF. And then, obviously, during the in the run-up to the Iraq War, Germany decides to oppose the war and doesn't send troops in that case. And I try to sort of examine the rhetoric of both Fischer and Schroeder. And it seems to me that Schroeder very much, particularly in the case of the Iraq War, uses a kind of a nationalist rhetoric that picks up Rudi Dutschke's German nationalism in the 1960s. That's one current. And the other current is very much the current embodied by Joschka Fischer, which is very much focused on the Nazi past and putting contrition for Auschwitz at the centre of German foreign policy and the centre of German identity, whereas Schroeder essentially, it seems to me, wants to draw a line under the Nazi past and say Germany is a normal country, essentially.
So I guess as a final question, have these 68ers been completely mainstreamed now? Because it doesn't seem to me that the positions that they take when they're in power are any different than, or they're slightly different, I suppose, than a Christian Democrat might, or some in the SPD. Have they become part of the establishment? I mean, have all the Adorno and Horkheimer, that business gone now?
Well, I mean, that's an accusation that's often leveled at them. I think actually that, and this is really the argument that I try to make in the book is that 1968 does influence them in power. It just does so in slightly more subtle ways. It doesn't do so in obvious ways, but it seems to me that both Schroeder and Fischer are influenced, particularly in the foreign policy of the Red-Green government, by these different ways in which they choose to engage with the Nazi past. And that, to me, seems actually to be one of the central elements of the 1968 generation in Germany that makes it different from contemporaneous protest movements in Britain or in the US. So I would argue that, you know, clearly their ideas had evolved over time, but nevertheless there was an influence of Adorno, actually. I mean, Adorno is a very good example. You know, Adorno does, I think, have you know, quite a visible influence on Joschka Fischer's vision of German foreign policy. So Adorno famously talks about how, in Negative Dialectics, talks about how that the Holocaust as Auschwitz has imposed a new categorical imperative on humanity to prevent a repetition of Auschwitz. And essentially what Joschka Fischer tries to do when he's in power is to base German foreign policy on this categorical imperative. So it does seem to me that he tries to make this German raison d'etat. Mm-hmm. So I think there is a very strong influence, actually, of these ideas which go back to 1968 on the foreign policy of the Red-Green government. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Well, it certainly has more influence than, I would just say that in the American case that some of these ideas had currency and that they fell away very quickly.
Right.
And you look at someone like Bill Clinton, he sort of forgot about all that. I mean, except for the fact that he may have smoked some marijuana, that was pretty much it. The 60s for him. But anyway, this is an absolutely fascinating book, and I congratulate you for writing it. I very much enjoyed talking to you about it and reading it, and I hope that other people go and read it, because, again, it really does help. I'll just speak as an American. It really did help me understand West German and now German history and politics in a much better way than I had before. Certainly much better than the impression that I got from watching the Baader-Meinhof complex,
right,
which was a good movie. But this
doesn't really give you the.
No, it really doesn't. This is really it's much more. It's a complicated story, and again, you find yourself cheering for people that you think you shouldn't be cheering for, and being sympathetic to people that you never thought you would be sympathetic for.
Right.
And I think that's a mark of your subtlety as a storyteller and your ability to kind of bring out the contradictions that these people faced. I mean, one of the things, just to go on for a second, that you point out in the book that I really quite liked is you know, in the political discourse of the United States, when people say, well, that's fascist, or this is fascist, or he's a fascist, it's just it's simply an analogy.
Yeah.
In the case of them, when they were pointing their fingers at people, some of them actually were fascists.
Yeah.
They were,
Absolutely.
Yeah. That really does make things very different, I think. And we have to pay attention to that. So anyway, thanks very much for the book. Let me ask you, Hans, to close the interview by answering our traditional final question on New Books in History, and that is, what are you working on now?
Right. I work at the European Council on Foreign Relations, which is a European foreign policy think tank based in London. And so I am doing quite a lot of work around German foreign policy, which in a sense is a kind of continuation, really, of the themes in the book. This has become quite a big issue in the last year or so since the euro crisis. There's been a lot of debate about a shift in German foreign policy that I think actually goes back to the Schröder government, the Red-Green government, but become particularly apparent in the last 12 months or so as Germany has responded to the euro crisis. So it's in a sense the sort of the next chapter, really, the way that the Merkel government has and the foreign policy of the Merkel government and the extent to which that continues certain developments that had been set in motion by Schröder. So that's one thing I'm working on. I'm also very interested at the moment in the history of Zionism, actually, and particularly the influence of German intellectual history and German nationalism in particular on early political Zionism. So I'm thinking about writing something around that theme.
Well, I hope you do. And then when you do, we'll have you back on the show. Anyway, Hans, thanks very much for being with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Hans Kundanani about his book, Utopia or Auschwitz, Germany's 1968 Generation and the Holocaust. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.